This is Johnny Bluestar. Welcome to Threshold, a global media event. Is the universe just a random dance of atoms? Or is it a manifestation of a supremely intelligent architect? Can its purpose, or our purpose here on Earth, be adequately assessed? Can we commune with it, know its intentions, cooperate with its direction? Here, we define Threshold as a gateway state of awareness, allowing mankind to cross into a place of real cognition. Threshold allows us to approach questions of higher reality through the door of experience rather than mere belief. Welcome to Threshold, where we tear away the veil from commercial media, bringing our audience and participants into another realm of reality and enhanced communication.
Hey, this is Johnny Bluestar. Welcome back to Threshold Radio, broadcast from the Waywalker Studio at Vegas All Net Radio, or VANR. Our program today is called Tremors on Wall Street. Can we save the U.S. economy? I think that's a great title. I sometimes feel these little earthquakes, these little tremors all the time, since I kind of follow the stock market in a slight way. Today, we are going to focus on Wall Street itself and its place in the U.S. economy. To this end, we're going to concentrate a bit on Ken Eade and Gordon L. Eade's new book called Terror on Wall Street. Gordon L. Eade was Ken's father and has recently passed away. While his father, Gordon, was still living, Ken began work on a largely nonfiction novel and at his request, turned it into a book of metafiction, a combination of nonfiction and suspense adventure story. Ken joins us in this discussion with Sarah Westall, a talk show host on a provocative and important program called Business Game Changers on the Conscious Business Network. She is an experienced technologist in computer science and internet infrastructures, as well as a consultant in entrepreneurial-oriented businesses. Her special interest is disruptive paradigms in business and technology that transform the world. Ken is an attorney, environmental and human rights activist, whose main avenue career-wise is working on several series of political and legal thrillers which focus on important social problems in America and the world. Terror on Wall Street, his book, seems particularly applicable now as the stock market's strange volatility is something that really can't be ignored. Good morning, Ken.
Good morning, Johnny. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning.
Good morning, everybody. Ken. Your book begins with a quote from no less a distinguished paradigm changer than Gene Roddenberry. Quote, "Our society is so fragile, so dependent on the interworking of things to provide us with goods and services that you don't need nuclear warfare to fragment us any more than the Romans needed it to cause their eventual downfall." Sarah, I hardly know a person that doesn't believe or at least fears some kind of impending financial collapse. I think it's fair to say that the U.S. and even the world economy is driven by a certain type of paradigm, one that has evolved in recent years. It involves the Federal Reserve, an array of central banks worldwide, the so-called quantitative easing or massive printing of currency, the regulation of interest rates, the International Monetary Fund, and various trade currencies, etc., etc. This kind of control over the economy started quite some time ago, but has advanced and kind of solidified over the past few decades. Wouldn't you say? How would you describe it in terms of its impactful, disruptive nature? And could it be, as many people think, quite negative in contributing to a potential collapse?
Well, I think it could contribute to a collapse, and there's a few reasons for this. I think the powers that be cannot outsmart the market. They don't know how to fix it. They are constantly tinkering in ways that are destructive, and the experts have varying opinions on what to do, which causes conflict. And there's just too much greed in the process. The Federal Reserve is owned by private banks, and their number one constituents are the owners of those banks themselves, not the U.S. people. And politicians, another problem is politicians do not understand economics, and their number one goal is to be reelected and liked by the people. So they make policy to that end. And after going off the gold standard, and this is one of the big reasons as well, after going off the gold standard, the dollar became a fiat currency. And the first few reasons that I described are the reasons why fiat currency will ultimately collapse, because history shows that fiat currencies have always collapsed. They're just inherently unstable because they don't have anything to tie it to create that stability.
Could we call this, maybe considering the amount of money that's being created, sort of a hyper fiat currency?
Well, it's like all fiat currencies, they become a hyper. That's why they collapse, because they become a hyperinflated currency, and then there becomes no value in them once there is that many dollars printed.
Right, the danger of hyperinflation.
Yes.
But still, in all, they are printing an awful lot of money these days without too much inflation so far.
Well, that's because they're printing on purpose to, and this is something I was going to talk about as well on the program, they're printing on purpose because there's deflationary pressure right now. We're in a global recession. And so there's huge deflationary pressure. And so they want to, because of our debt and our situation, they have a 2.5% interest goal that they try to maintain every year. And by printing and monetary easing, they have pretty much maintained that inflationary goal. Although in some sectors of our economy, it's been way higher inflation than that. And other things have deflated, as we all know. The stock market, another thing that they did is, you know, everybody lost their portfolios. And by doing this monetary easing and creating an inflationary pressure, it caused the stock market to go up. So people feel their portfolios are back to normal, which they aren't.
Well, you know, Ken,
yeah.
We've been speaking in broad generalities to introduce the problem. But could you describe the early setting of your book, which take us into the midst of a bloody terrorist attack, throwing American society into a complex, chaotic, and dangerous panic? Several of your characters, Snooki, a brilliant but rather detached woman, perhaps slightly out of touch with reality, and Ike Pendleton, a researcher specializing in neuroscience, are trying to get to Washington from Chicago, facing the reality of trying to survive in this rapidly deteriorating environment. Could you describe the scenes depicting this disaster in your novel?
Sure. In Terror on Wall Street, a terrorist attack on retail market chains causes a panic in the market as well as a run on the banks. And the attack is focused on the retail food supply, which is very delicate and volatile system because it depends on the prompt payment of invoices. I wanted to show how in this type of a collapse, how difficult simple things that we take for granted, like going to the grocery store, getting gas, and in this case, getting from point A to point B, Washington from Chicago, is a pretty easy thing. You know, we could jump on a plane, we could jump in a car, but I wanted to show how difficult these simple things we take for granted would be if we're placed in this type of situation.
Forgetting for a moment the actual terrorist event, which in your book initiates the crisis, how do you think a financial collapse without that component could affect America? Would it have the same things exactly in your novel, the gas shortages, the bank problems, the looting? Or would it really mirror these scenes, do you think?
Well, I think a true crisis, financial crisis, like the type that was averted in 2008, if it would have played its way out, would be actually worse than a series of terrorist attacks. And these are the type of things that we can expect to happen. People feel safe if their money is guaranteed by the government, but with a massive bank failure, where's that money going to come from to pay back all those FDIC guarantees? It's just not going to happen. The Federal Reserve, as Sarah mentioned before, has been pretty good at creating inflationary trends to minimize the national debt. That, you know, makes it easier for them to collect more money in taxes, and it actually makes them able to pay less debt back. But in a true collapse, it wouldn't be able to collect enough tax money to pay those debts. So I think I think the terror we'd actually see is worse than if we were attacked by terrorists.
So I'm going to ask you both. Do you think imminently there's an economic doomsday ahead of us, a stock market crash, a currency collapse, hyperinflation, anything that could radically change our lifestyle in that direction? Sarah?
Well, I do think it's going to happen. I don't think it's going to, it'll be a doomsday type. I mean, it might feel like one in the months after it happens. But I think that just like it did in the Weimar Republic in Germany and in other countries, it, your country eventually restructures itself and there's a healthy cleansing and you come out on the other side.
With Hitler?
Well, no, that's a good example of what happens, though, is there can be a healthy cleansing and then there can be a rise because it's so radical. There can be a rise of all sorts of, but we're seeing that now. Look at the kind of politicians that we're seeing now rise.
Trump.
Yeah, I mean,
you have to listen to is a debate, at least in the Republican arena.
Oh, it's actually hilarious. I mean, it's sad because it's very serious subjects, but it was probably one of the most entertaining shows I've seen in a long time.
Really?
Maybe more than that's the thing. That's the thing. It's the biggest multi-billion-dollar TV attraction. You know, every 4 years, and they've always thought the financial elite has always thought that they've had the edge on it because they've got the most money. But now we got someone who just comes up and basically with no money, just because he can command press, is taking control of the whole thing.
And what kind of a debate can you really have about these issues when you have 30 seconds to say something and maybe the same amount of time to follow up? I mean,
you had the entertainment factor into it.
But you can really call some names, some really good names in between the discussions.
You have to admit it, there hasn't been another debate that has been like this. The past presidential elections have at least been, they've been kind of mean to each other and things, but it's still had a level of professionalism. And this is just... It's at a whole nother level. It's really entertaining, but it's sad.
Yeah, it is really entertaining, I have to admit. We're going to go to a break now.
We are happy to provide our audience with two very exciting musical odysseys with Stephanie Slevin, a singer-songwriter from the United Kingdom. One is called Show Number 7, A Galaxy of Song, and the other is Show 21, I Talk with Angels, in our Threshold Radio archives in VegasAllNetRadio.com and YouTube. Here's one of our songs.
My way, and I say, big shot. You can choke.
Slevin, a UK songwriter that we are presenting many of her songs here, and that will give you a feeling of what can happen if there is a collapse. Those were the London riots, but I think it is somewhat applicable. I want to begin, we're going to be talking about everything, but right now, why don't you tell us how and why you helped your father with this book and why Gordon Ead would want to write a book like this in the first place?
Well, my dad, Gordon Ead, was what I would like to call a financial wizard. He was pretty much the opposite of me. I remember him saying he's been a saver all his life and he didn't know how to spend money. I said, "Yeah, Dad, I know. I've been a spender all my life and I don't know how to, I don't know how to save money." He was able to retire before he was 54 years old entirely on his investments. And he weathered all these financial crises and every crash that we've had since the 1970s. And every time I picked up this manuscript that he asked me to work on, I thought I couldn't do it. But as his Alzheimer's disease got worse, I focused on one of the main characters, which is Professor Mason. And I actually gave him early Alzheimer's. And that made me feel like my dad was a character in the book that was helping guide me with the story. It's kind of difficult and different than what I usually do.
Very poignant, though. There is a certain thread of certain personal, the personal foibles and characteristics of these characters that makes it very interesting, because you were trying to communicate not only the sort of terror of the situation, but actual concrete factual realities and theories about what can be done. Ike and Snooki, who we described as characters in your book, are trying to get to Washington. The purpose of their journey is to connect with a few classmates in a special workshop developed by Professor Harry Mason, who you just mentioned, who's been asked to give a presentation to the Senate Finance Committee. In fact, their workshop was convened with one main purpose: to save the world economy from total collapse. Ken, would you give us an overview of this workshop and how is it structured to actually save the world economy?
Sure. Without spoiling the story, Professor Mason has, for his graduate-level study course, picked each of the students, handpicked them, each one that participates in the workshop, and each of them has been picked because they have a special talent in economics. One's a specialist in neuroeconomics, studying why the brain makes the decisions that it does. Another is an expert in computerized trading systems. Another one's a stockbroker. And he brings them all together as a team of experts to work on proposed legislation to give to the to our leaders of our country to try to solve what he feels are our main economic problems. And in the midst of this workshop, we have an actual economic crisis.
Well, Sarah, one of the functions of this emerging paradigm that I see is the government-enforced reliance on citizens' retirement being tied to Wall Street. Was it fair to provide pension plans that were based on stock portfolios to workers? Was it right to provide 401k retirement plans based also on stock to people wanting to safeguard their future? Give us an idea of what happened to these type of people, to people who wanted to retire, who wanted a savings, in 2008.
Well, I think there's well-meaning people that wanted to allow average people to take advantage of the rise in the stock market that does happen. But what that also creates is these pension funds had huge amounts of cash in it. And so the people that, the powers that be in that, we're a capitalist society, and they see that as a golden goose. There's piles of monies. We need to go after that. And so there was a lot of pressure to get those funds to be used for all sorts of purposes. And we saw the results of, basically what happened with these piles of money is that there wasn't always ethical usages of them, right? And people just try to make money off what they can. And they don't see the bigger consequences of what they're trying to do. Some people do, and then that's just plain old criminal behavior. Other people just want to make money for themselves, and they just don't understand the bigger consequences. But, you know, one of the main effects of the quantitative easing and the money printing was to substantially rise the market and get their portfolios back to what they were, you know, back in 2008. Not everybody have seen that, you know, their portfolios rise to that level. People got scared and got out of the market and lost everything. But for those that stayed in, the substantial part of their portfolio has been, you know, re-intact.
Well, I have another question. You know, for a long time, I didn't have a savings account. I had a checking account, a corporate account, a personal account, but I didn't really bother with a savings account. And then recently I went to a bank and I wanted to get a savings account. And I found out that the interest was rather low.
Yeah, it's kind of a joke.
What has really happened here? I mean, maybe it was a CD, 3-5% interest or something like that, you know, something that at least had a little meat on the bone. This didn't have any meat at all. It was just a few copper pennies. How did that happen?
Well, are you asking me?
Yes.
Well, I wasn't sure if you wanted to talk to Ken now. Well,
I want to talk to Ken, but...
No, he's great. basically, banks need to make money, and they think that people will put money into their accounts and they don't need to pay them. I mean, they know that people are not using it as investment vehicles. So, plus when the banks, when the Glass-Steagall Act fell, you know, when it wasn't before that came back, but when they took away the banking regulations, which allowed banks to go into financial investments, what incentive is it to a bank who can also get the people into their financial investment products to allow a savings account to have good interest? All that does is motivate people to keep it in your savings account. They want people out of there and into their financial products.
So you're saying this was completely dictated by the greed of banks. And this had nothing to do with how they got money from the Federal Reserve or anything like that.
Well, I think the Federal Reserve getting money, I mean, I was, you know, from decades ago, it started a while ago where the interest rates on savings accounts have been low. But getting money from the Federal Reserve at such a low interest rate, that pretty much gave banks the ability to get money for free, right? They had investment money for free. It allowed them to make money off the government, off of us. But banks, we have to understand, banks are there to make money. I mean, we're kidding ourselves to think that banks are in the business to do anything else but to make money for themselves and their shareholders.
So, Ken, you agree with that, that this is basically a matter of greed, that they have deprived people from saving in the United States from saving without the risk of stock portfolios?
Well, I agree that it's a matter of capitalism. I agree with Sarah 100%. In fact, if you go into Bank of America and open a new account, while you're opening the new account, they'll send the Merrill Lynch guy over to talk to you.
Yeah, well, that's I understand that. But what I don't understand is why a poor person isn't able to save money in a relatively safe way anymore. That's depriving the American people of...
There's no return on safe investments. That's the problem.
You could put it in annuities, you know, things like that. Those are fairly safe, but you don't make any... You don't get an interest rate if the market doesn't go up, but you don't lose money either. You know,
You can do what my dad suggested, and that's play the whole market with index funds. But that involves a risk, but the risk is not as much as trying to figure out what the market's doing on your own.
Well, we're going to take a break now and recover from this loss of being able to save money. here we go.
It is the 15th century. El Tesoro de Cielo, a Spanish treasure ship, sends a scouting expedition to a strange island. Golden statues surrounding them prove the enormity of their find. Suddenly, hordes of ghoulish creatures with scaly green flesh and skeletal wings descend upon them from the sky.
What do you think of this, Rufio?
These creatures are fragile, Captain. We could take them with our swords.
They seem supernatural. Who knows what powers they possess?
Fallen angels, weakened by their treason.
My God, are you saying they're Nephilim, the devil's host?
I'm saying whatever they are, we can take them. Do any of you cowards dare join me?
Up against sharp knife-like nails and hideous fangs, the men's swords rip into slimy green flesh. Though black blood pours copiously from their half-naked bodies, creatures miraculously persist. Can the crew survive this bloody, cursed battle?
Find out more by Googling The Thrice Born, a new sci-fi supernatural novel by Carlos Lopez Avery and Johnny Bluestar. Google with the words Carlos Johnny Kendall, The Thrice Born. That's Carlos Johnny Kendall, The Thrice Born.
If you like Threshold Radio, a program which deals with core issues affecting our personal, political, and spiritual lives, and advocates the creation of an enlightened, informed citizenry, not only in America, but throughout the world, then you might think of supporting both your product and business and our message by advertising on our show. All programs are archived and are supported in various ways, including social media, our outreach being broadcast weekly on VegasAllNetRadio.com, a very advanced internet broadcasting station, but also archived directly on our websites on YouTube and in SoundCloud. We believe in time we will have a very broad outreach. Through New Galaxy Enterprises, our parent company, we can create a wide range of marketing and advertising components to complement your advertising on Threshold Radio and increase your outreach in many creative and exciting ways. If interested, just go to www.thresholdradio.com and fill out a contact form with your interest. That's www.thresholdradio.com.
Going back to the sort of general economy, particularly in the past recently, I'm asking this to both of you. In 2008, what do you think of the financial manipulations and the bailouts? How much validity was there in the, quote, solutions that they had? And how much was just really based on providing unfair advantages to certain big players and taking quite a few big businesses out of the game? Sarah?
Well, a financial collapse of a large institution such as Lehman Brothers did and will cause a collapse of the system unless, you know, we really intervene, which is what happened, especially with all the derivative exposures. So, you know, unfortunately, bailing out those big firms is something that we have to do unless we have major structural changes where we break up those big banks. But I do think that they did play games and allowed certain members to fail and others not, because they're all competitors. We had the irrational ego game in the middle of that whole collapse, and then they got scared because they realized what they did, and then they had to save the system. That's what I think happened.
How about you, Ken?
I agree. I mean, I think what's happened is these banks have gotten too big, and if we lose one of them, it's going to be a domino effect, and we're going to lose all of them. This whole system's going to go down. Whereas if they had not been allowed to become so big, if you have a bank failure here or a bank failure there, it would be something that's isolated and easier to handle. But I absolutely agree with her.
I think that there's one candidate, Bernie Sanders, who had said for sure that he would like to break up these big banks.
It's not going to happen.
Well, okay, I'm not saying it's going to happen.
Well, it's an example of the structural changes that need to happen and the courage of the politicians to do it. And I would have to agree with Ken that it won't happen. I think there has to be a major distress before we do it. Another 2008 type collapse where we don't have the ammunition and multiple banks are going to collapse, and then we'll be forced to do it because the banks have too much power. They're the ones running our world.
Well, here's a controversial question, Ken. In your book, you begin with one of your characters, Bob Bramman, a student but also a salesman at J.C. Morrison Securities, discovering a seemingly anonymous player shorting major amounts of transportation stocks as well as Walmart and other retailers. Later in the day, as previously mentioned, you describe how terrorist attacks on Walmart supercenters, key areas throughout the country, take place. There have been controversial discussions about the shorting of United and American Airlines stock prior to 9/11. Some commentators saying that although shorting happened and nothing to do with terrorists, while others say it actually happened that way. Do you think this kind of linkage has happened before in reality?
Well, yeah, I do, because one of the books that I used in my research when I did Terror on Wall Street was James Rickards, who wrote a book called The Death of Money. And in The Death of Money, he describes that a friend of his who's an expert said, oh, yeah, it was the biggest case of insider trading that I've ever seen in my life. And, you know, the people in the terrorist organizations were profiting from the terrorist attacks. And that was a reason why the government looked into doing forming a task force, which James Rickards was a part of, to work on a program to make a system to where we could see this coming and try to deal with it. Unfortunately, the government sacked the program, but Rickards was envisioning a hedge fund where terrorist groups would slowly and carefully make their investments for this very purpose, and this could contribute or actually cause a stock market crash of epidemic proportions. So I absolutely do believe in it.
You know, Harry's specialty, Harry Mason, in your book, was called Modern Portfolio Theory. And that, I take it, had a little bit to do with what your father actually did. What was that exactly, and how does it bear on Harry's mission and his theory for averting long-term disaster for the U.S. economy?
Well, modern portfolio theory is, you're right, it's what my father, Gordon Eid, based his investments on. And one of the, you know, that and was postulated as a theory by Harry Markowitz in the 1950s when he wrote a thesis on it that won him a Nobel Prize. And it was basically linking risk to return. And this theory was an efficient portfolio is one where no added diversification can lower the portfolio's risk for a given return expectation, and no additional return can be gained without increasing the risk of the portfolio. So one of the axioms of this theory is that current market prices are reflecting the total knowledge and expectations of all the investors in the market. And no one investor can consistently know more than the market does collectively. So my father's theory was to invest in index funds because the idea is that the best way to beat the market is to invest in the entire market without trying to figure out what particular part of the market is going to rally and what's not.
And he wanted to choose those indices very carefully, right? Because there are
there's a lot of them. But you know, the point is that these index funds are spreading risk over, you know, a large amount of securities, as opposed to mutual funds, which have different people picking, you know, what stocks that they want to go with. So he was always a consistent investor with Vanguard. Basically, yeah. That's what he pitches.
Sarah, you know, in Ken's book Terror on Wall Street, there's a lot of skepticism about the way the public is informed and advised by professional brokers as to how to handle their portfolios. Do you think in general the public is being ripped off? Is Wall Street basically unbeatable without very special knowledge?
Well, I think that's absolutely true. Well, we got to think of what a broker is, right? They're not very educated on the market. I don't think they fundamentally understand the majority of them. There might be a few here and there that are whizzes and they get it, but in general they don't, and their motive is to make money. So being ignorant and wanting to make money is a very dangerous combination, right? And then who their clients are pretty ignorant too. So it's just ignorance. And you know, talking about what you were just talking about the index funds versus the market, I mean, if you ever try to look at some of these stocks and – you know, I've had situations where I've invested in a stock that did amazing all through 2008. Profits were higher than, you know, they just were doing stellar, but their stock was stagnant. And then other companies who should be bankrupt are just exploding. And that's the kind of irrational performance of these companies that turns a normal financial person who's been studying the market for a long time to go, man, I can't figure this out. I can't figure this out. We need to do something that's a smart index fund because over time it'll balance out. But it's so irrational that you got to go with a smarter plan.
You know, going back to 2008 again, do you both of you, do you feel there was a lot of criminality involved in this? It's often said that not one top executive or serious player was prosecuted. Wasn't there a bunch of fraud involved or mishandling of money? What do you think?
Absolutely. Wow. There's that going on. And that's one of the reasons why it's so hard as a normal person, unless you're an insider. You know, that's why the index funds are so important, because unless you're an insider, you don't know what games they're playing. You know, gold and silver have been manipulated since the dawn of time. You know, we just know they are. And there's some very, very obvious examples. But let's look at Goldman Sachs, how they manipulated the just the U.S. government to bail themselves out and made it. They had AIG got bailed out so that they could get paid 100% on their derivatives.
Right.
You know, that how they basically ripped off the American people. Or how about when they dumped toxic funds on their clients, unsuspecting customers, knowing that they were just trying to get out of those funds, knowing that those people would be destroyed by them. Yeah, that has to be criminal.
So what do you think of the fact that these people weren't seemingly prosecuted at all?
Well, I did a big show on it. I did a 2-hour, almost 3-hour show on it. On the lack of prosecutions of executives in Wall Street, and it's awful. that's the crux of some of our issues. The corruption is terrible. That's part of the reason why a collapse is a way of cleansing out the system, right? I mean, it's awful.
Well, right now the markets. I'm sorry, Ken. Go ahead.
No, I mean, after the 2008 crisis, we had a redistribution of wealth, and basically the losers were the American middle class. But the losers could easily, in the next crash, be the financial elite, because the whole system would be reset, and these people that have been artificially keeping their, you know, their casino betting. The house's money in their own casino going for so many years could be the losers.
Well, that would be a nice situation. Nice outcome. I don't know.
Well, you know, looking at things right now, the market seems very vulnerable. The Fed says something, the price of oil changes, some official says the oil price may change. This Japanese central banks approve negative interest rates. There's a slight change in employment or consumer buying in the U.S., and stock markets throughout the world go completely red or start to prosper powerfully for a few days. Are these tremors, guys, indicating perhaps an impending calamity, this volatility? Sarah?
Well, I think that it shows that we have a lot of just volatility in general. I mean, we're on the brink of World War III, right? I mean, we have all that buildup in Syria, 250,000 troops. The U.S. and Russia did some kind of truce of peace, but how is that going to work? Because they didn't bring the parties that are actually fighting to do the peace agreement. Mm. It's like me and you deciding that those two people over there are going to stop fighting. I don't know if that's really going to work. And the problem is they're Russia and the United States are the ones, you know, funding it. So there's just so much volatility all over the place. So the market is reflecting just the chaos everywhere. I mean, we got the debt, we got the wars, we got the fighting over oil. You know, there's all this energy alternatives that are popping up, but oil is the back of the dollar. It's crazy. And so, yeah, can it cause that? Yeah. Or can the war kind of allow it to prolong longer? You know, it gives us something to focus on and invest our money in and helps the economy, unfortunately.
Ken, what do you think of these tremors, this volatility?
No, I agree absolutely with Sarah. And I think that behind every war the United States gets involved in, or every military conflict they like to call it, there's absolutely a profit motive. And, you know, as I exposed in my book to Russia for Love, the whole involvement of the United States in the Ukraine is all about backing our chemical companies for genetically engineered food, and backing our oil and gas companies. And they've got actually got people sitting on the board of the biggest gas company in the Ukraine that are the son of Joe Biden and John Kerry's godson. They're just blatantly just, you know, that's when wherever you follow the U.S. war machine, you can bet there's money behind it.
Well, we're going to contemplate this while we go to a break for a second. I think the song that we're going to be dealing with is something that should be in our minds too.
Patty Greer journeyed to England to investigate crop circles, eventually becoming a filmmaker, chronicling this phenomena and serving as a kind of intermediary between the unknown creators and a humanity on the brink of global disaster. Hear her complete story by visiting Show One, Patty Greer, Crop Circle Mysteries, in our Threshold Radio Archives in Vegas, AllNetRadio.com, and YouTube. Here's one of her songs.
I think that we need a little more of that than perhaps what we have in the stock market and in Syria and everywhere else. In regards to the market itself, here is a very interesting explanation of how markets move given by your character in Terror on Wall Street, whose name is Bob Braman. Market prices move on the basis of random events that become known throughout the day. Some of the events may have been anticipated by the market, while other events were not anticipated by the market and appear to be random. It is not at all unusual for the price to fall on a security when a dividend is raised or when a higher dividend was anticipated by the market. That's kind of the volatility that I was speaking of before. I'm focusing on the phrase, move on the basis of random events. Ken, could you explain more about the term random in this context? Explain if the actual response to the random event that affects prices is rationally grounded.
Sure. Every trading day, billions of shares are trading. And most of those trades are going to occur on orders of professional traders, managers of pension funds and mutual funds and hedge funds and trusts. But the rest of them are transactions of individual investors who are investing for their own account. And during the trading day, these prices are going to move according to supply and demand of respective parties. And the publication of new developments and news of specific companies is immediately incorporated into stock prices. People really can't play the market. Normal people can't play the market unless they have inside information, because the market's already anticipated and digested and this news, and it's already incorporated into the price of the stock. So there's hundreds of thousands of investors competing with you, the average investor seeking to buy stocks that are undervalued or overvalued to buy at any instant time. Prices of securities are going to change when some unanticipated event occurs and investors react to this event. That's why it's virtually impossible to beat the market, because by the time you react to this trend on whatever random event it was, the market's already reacted to it and adjusted the price accordingly.
Well, I think one of the things that I found really interesting related to this kind of decision making, was Ike Pendleton's specialty of neuroeconomics. According to a website developed by the Society of Neuroeconomics, neuroeconomics is, quote, a nascent field that represents the confluence of economics, psychology, and neuroscience in the study of human decision making. The Society of Neuroeconomics, according to their statement, quote, exists to foster research on the foundations of economic behavior by promoting collaboration and discussion among scholars from the psychological, economic, and neural fields, and to ensure the continued advancement of this field of neuroeconomics by supporting young researchers. I think it might be fair to say that this is an application or subdivision of cognitive science. Could you explain a little bit more about this, Ken?
Sure. It's kind of, the way you said it, it's like science meets economics. It's relatively new scientific discipline where scientists study how the brain makes decisions that involve taking and managing of risk, and they've focused on the limbic system for impulsive decisions that are made, and that's kind of like my dad's theory that Wall Street was aware of how the brain works and how it makes decisions, and every day as an investor, your sensory system is bombarded with all this information that may or may not be beneficial to you as an investor if it's not properly evaluated by this ancient part of your brain. So the anticipation of receiving an award, like you're seeing your portfolio go up 3 days in a row, like what typically happens in with an IPO that someone's bought into, because the law actually gives the underwriter the opportunity to legally manipulate the market to get the issue off. If people see that happening over a period of a few days, they figure, oh wow, this is great. It's like a shot of heroin to a heroin addict. So this is the idea of the study of neuroeconomics, which is actually experimenting with animals and with humans to figure out how we make these risk reward decisions.
Well, partially that's because why it can be correlated with animals is because it's kind of instinctive behavior, and you're going for, in the human mind, I think you're going for narratives that make strong promises, and you're so attracted to those narratives that it's like an addictive substance, and it overrides your rational thinking. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's kind of yes. Go ahead, Sarah.
The when he's saying ancient brain, there's a whole study called the reptile brain, and I had my class this year. We did a lot of stuff, or big segment on marketing, tapping into the reptile brain, and it's really a big push in all business to figure out how to get to people's subconscious when you're marketing anything. And so Wall Street just jumped on that bandwagon and figured out how to do marketing and how to get to people's subconscious. And the interesting
thing—go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say the interesting thing is taking it to another step and trying to figure out how to, because the market has always been very irrational. It's a very emotional beast. And the interesting thing is seeing if they can actually figure out the science behind it and see if there's patterns and something that you can figure out.
The other thing I wanted to say, Sarah, based on that, is the reverse is also correct, I think. And that's that the studies say that people don't want to lose their money. And so when you start to see a downhill trend, instead of riding it out, people will get in there and they'll sell, which is actually the time when people like Warren Buffett go in there and buy. But it causes a huge downslide on this emotional sell-off.
Well, yeah. And you have to, in order to do that, you have to have a lot of cash on the sidelines, right?
Yeah,
because true. And so it
True.
Takes a different type of unless you're an actual investor in your life and that's what you do for a living, it's hard for average people to have that kind of cash. Just they're living their life and letting their money just invest. And so, it's hard for the average person because that's not what they do.
I think there's a correlation between this kind of instinctive thinking and the way the American people have accepted all the ridiculous aspects of the American economy, but also how they've accepted the political, the political situation where they hardly feel the incentive to really vote in primaries at all. They don't really participate. They get some kind of enthusiasm during presidential elections, but they're not really taking responsibility for what's happening to them, which is a deterioration of their citizen and human rights right in their face. So it seems like they are being driven by sort of semi-conscious forces which promise things, but like security and safety or money and, you know, security, but they're really not there at all. Those things are not there, and they're refusing to see them. Well, I'm afraid we're moving in towards the next hour. I want to thank both of you for our conversation so far, and I think we'll get much more deeply into Terror on Wall Street. Why don't you tell us something about how to get a hold of that book real quick?
Oh, sure. You can get Terror on Wall Street or any of the other nine novels I've written by going to Amazon.com, or you can go to my website, which is kennethe.com, KennetheAde.com, and you can pick up Terror on Wall Street through a link there.
Well, we're going to go out with a clip from Edgar Ahrens, my friend in Russia, who's a composer, his musical score called Escape.